Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. Today I'm with Nina Diamond. Nina is a humorist, a journalist. She's written for Omni, the Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times Magazine. She was also a performer and humorist with Pandemonium on NPR. Good morning, Nina.
Hello.
Hello.
Nice to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here. You came to my attention, actually, when I was interviewing Mallory Tenori a few weeks back, and she mentioned that when I asked her who were good people in social media, who were good tweeters, and she mentioned you as one of her top picks, just, you know, because of she likes reading the stuff that you do, but also what you've been able to do with lists. And actually, you wrote a story for her at pointer.org about lists. So how did you get to be so good at social media?
When people ask me what I think the key is to using social media, I think they might be surprised by my answer, because quite often we see things written or we hear interviews with experts and self-appointed experts about social media who like to give a lot of tips. And everything is very general. It's not tailored to the person's goals. You know, you will see crazy things like, what's the best time of day to tweet, you know. Well, that really all depends on what you do and who your followers are. There is no best time of day to tweet in general. You know, so there'd be very broad, crazy things like that about using social media effectively. And what I think all of these were missing is that social media, like any other form of media, is a way of communicating. And it all boils down to the personality and the skills and the goals and objectives of the person doing the communicating. So this is, I know, a long answer to a short question, but what makes anybody effective in any form of communication is going to be simply their skills at communicating. I joke all the time that I started talking when I was 9 months old, which is true, and I haven't shut up since. So I'm a good communicator. It comes naturally to me, born this way. I think it's something that maybe is inherent in people. They have the gift for gab. Those of us who write, you know, we have, you know, a talent for communicating. And then really it becomes about polishing those skills, becoming better at it. For me, I feel that the most effective use of Twitter is to be yourself, is to not approach it in a sterile way, like some people do, where it's totally devoid of feeling and personality. You know, I think what makes effective tweeting is the same thing that makes any form of communication effective.
Now, what attracted you to this? What made you decide, you know, hey, I want to try social media, I want to do this? Did you have a particular, you know, goal in mind? Did you say, oh, I've heard that this is a good way to get, you know, get promotion out there or something? Or did you just sort of, you know, wander into it?
I joined Twitter in the summer of 2010, right at the point where it was becoming basically an international newsroom. And so that was what brought me in. I probably could have come in a little bit sooner, and because it had become a newsroom, you know, a little before then. And that was what brought me in. And I think that since then, any journalist who had been skeptical about the value of Twitter isn't skeptical anymore, because the news is breaking there through independent journalists and as well as those attached to specific news organizations. The news will break there even before the news organizations will have something, you know, in their newspapers, in print or online or on television. You know, you'll see quite often a reporter, for example, from CNN is breaking the story on Twitter, and it's an hour before you actually see it on the air on CNN. So Twitter really has become the breaking news forum as well as an international newsroom. And I think every journalist needs to be there in some way.
Now, do you remember what your aha moment was? I can tell you sort of what mine was actually the Japanese earthquake, where I was watching it on television and had my phone next to me, and I'd been tweeting, you know, for just a couple of months, and I started, you know, I just went to the Twitter stream and started seeing things just pop up and people reacting and, you know, people going, oh, well, here's a place where you can, you know, send out relief aid, and here's you know the latest thing I've heard from this news outlet. It was just each of the news outlets covering it from different ways, and people you know providing information from Japan. So do you remember your moment where you said, "Oh, this yeah, this makes sense."
I think that I felt from the beginning that it was an important place to be. That I think I've had many many aha moments since I started on Twitter. I think the timing of when I started was that I came into it sort of already with that aha feeling of here's basically my office. You know, I've always had my office at home, though I have also sometimes had some offices at magazines and newspapers. You know, I've been a freelance journalist for 30 years, so I've worked on assignment for many newspapers, magazines, been a regular contributor to many of them. But my office primarily has been at home. And when I joined Twitter, I came to realize instantly that Twitter was now my office. And there have been countless aha moments that reinforced the important news value of Twitter since in the 2.5 years that I've been on. Almost every really large story, whether it's confined to the U.S. or it's international, it's abroad, has just reinforced to me how important it is. And it really gets the journalist adrenaline going to be, you know, watching this break in real time and be a part of a chain of information that gets spread out. Because, you know, even if you're not the journalist on the ground reporting the story, you are one of countless journalists who are tweeting links to the people's stories, you know, retweeting and making comments and passing along the tweets that of other people's reporting so that you can share this with your followers. And there are a lot of people who are in the media, who are journalists as well as civilians, as I call them, who follow journalists and have set their Twitter feeds up so that this is how they're getting their news. So I know from the feedback I get from my followers that I'm a news source for them. When there's breaking news, they are really happy that I'm there passing along things that they can trust because they feel, well, a professional journalist has vetted this and she's only going to pass things along in her feed that we know we can trust. And it, you know, of course, mistakes happen and corrections have to be made sometimes, and we all do those, and they know that will happen, you know, as well.
So how do you do a correction? You know, if you get a name wrong or a fact wrong, how do you let people know?
I can do it in multiple ways. If someone reports something and I retweet either manually where I have actually typed out RT and at so-and-so and then I, you know, type out their, you know, their tweet, it's a link to something and maybe there is an error that they made in their tweet and I might do a manual RT of it that may or may not have a comment of my own that I put in front of it. If it's that kind of retweet or an automatic one where you just click the retweet button and it's basically a snapshot of their tweet that goes out in your timeline. Either way, if there's a mistake that is in somebody's tweet, as soon as I become aware of it, I will either put a tweet out that has a correction in it, as well as deleting the incorrect one. Sometimes I'll just delete the incorrect one, and then if that person has corrected it, I will then put their correction straight out there without, you know, my own comment. But it depends really on what the error is, how they've handled it, whether it's that they made an error of some sort or I made one. You know, there are a lot of different ways you can correct it, but I always make sure that people will see in my timeline that it's been corrected and that I will go ahead and delete the one that's incorrect. And the reason I delete it is that a lot of times people aren't paying close attention and they'll go look at a Twitter stream and they'll see this tweet, not realizing that a few tweets down the road is a correction. So they'll see this incorrect tweet, not know it's incorrect, and they might retweet it. So I don't want incorrect information to continue to be sent out, so I will go ahead and delete the incorrect one.
So it's funny what you were saying before that, you know, people come to you as a journalist to sort of vet some of this news. Mm-hmm. We've been trying to set up this interview for a couple of weeks and playing phone tag. And actually, the last time I touched base with you, or tagged you, as it were, you said that you were the Pope is stepping down. I'm tweeting this, so but you know I caught you at the moment of breaking news. So what how did you tweet out the Pope? What were you doing?
Well, because I follow close to 3,000 Twitter accounts, and a large portion of that is media outlets and people in the media and other information sources. So I have got a tremendous amount of information coming in. And then on top of that, there will be retweets that come into my timeline that alert me to maybe someone I hadn't been following or hadn't put on my list, you know, to, which is also another way of following people unofficially. You can follow them through your list as opposed to officially, you know, in your follower account. Retweets of stuff will come in. Also, I'll do a search when there's a breaking story. I'll search some keywords because I want to see what's out there. There are often reporters on the ground who I am not following, and they, you know, because, you know, there's tens of thousands of reporters around the world. You can't be following all of them. So when the Pope story broke, for example, I would go do a search, and I'm going to see who's out there, what are they saying, what might I want to retweet or do an original tweet with maybe a link to their story or something like that. So it's a combination of things. And quite often, if I'm at home with my laptop and I've got the TV on and I'll be watching, switching around, especially if it's something that's very, very big, where I know that all of the cable news channels are going to have live coverage of something, and I'll switch around all of them to see what they're saying, what they're reporting, what the video they're showing. So it's sort of a two-screen kind of operation.
It sounds like what you're trying to do is organize the Twitterverse, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. I mean, I've always wanted to organize the universe so it functioned to my liking, and Twitter in a certain way lets you do that. At least, in part, you get to order your own news universe in an organized way.
Okay. And now it was the way you sort of presented this, I found it kind of interesting. You sort of made it seem, you know, I assume that you're not getting paid to do this. This is part of what you do.
This is, people have asked me all the time, well, you know, how can somebody monetize being on Twitter? Well, that's like saying, how do you monetize your networking, and how do you monetize your Rolodex, your list of contacts?
Right.
You know, Twitter is just a tool that we use to better do things that we used to do using other tools. So as a journalist, I'm constantly networking through Twitter. Almost every person I've interviewed in the last 2.5 years has been initiated first through contact on Twitter. Interviewed for stories that I have sold to publications. I have made my first contact with them through Twitter. So it's a way of networking with people. It's a very fast way to contact people directly to them, as opposed to calling up and having to go through multiple people till their various representatives or whomever, if they have them. You know, you can get people very, very quickly. And I'm constantly interacting with editors as well. So, for example, Mallory at Pointer, when I did the article for them on Lyft, that came about because Julie, who was the editorial director of Pointer Online, she and I were following each other on Twitter, and she sent me a message asking if I would like to do a story about Lyft. She liked my use of Lyft in Twitter and asked if I'd like to write an article about it. And Mallory is the managing editor at Pointer, and among various other things, oversees those kinds of how-to articles. So she then introduced me to Mallory. So whether a journalist is interacting with a potential source or a source or a potential person to interview or profile, or an editor that either may ask them to do an article or whom you might want to pitch an article, all of that is going on Twitter simultaneously with also the tweets that we journalists send out having to do with news. It could be that I'm covering a big news event, and by covering I mean not that I'm on the ground, where this is happening, but I am relaying the information of the people who are through my Twitter stream. Or it could be that I am sending out a tweet with a link to an article that I've done that's in a magazine or a newspaper or other publication. Every time one of my pieces is published, obviously I'm going to put that out through Twitter. Often when there are breaking stories or maybe an anniversary of something, I will also put out a tweet with a link to a story I've done in the past. You know, I've got 30 years worth of stories. So many of them are in online archives. Some aren't, but, the majority of them are from the various newspapers and magazines. And even if I did a story in the 80s or the 90s, before a publication, was online, they, if they're a big publication and they're still in existence, they've got everything archived. I used to write a lot for the Sunday magazine that was called Sunshine of the Sun Sentinel, which at the time was called the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel. And although Sunshine, like many Sunday magazines, was shut down in the late 90s, all of my articles are archived online. So, and that is the case also with, many other publications that may or may not still be around. So I will tweet links to some of my past articles when it makes sense, to do that.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how you use lists and how journalists can use lists to help them do their job better.
Lists are the most important tool that Twitter offers to keep organized. Unfortunately, they have not upgraded the ability of their lists as they have upgraded other functions over the years, and many of us are hoping they will do that soon. So at this point, you still can only make 20 lists, and you can only have 500 in each. That sounds like a lot, but it isn't, not by a long shot. You can make these lists with any kinds of categories that you'd like. You can choose to name them anything that you want and put anybody in them that you want. These lists become an active second incoming Twitter feed. When you click on a list, you can watch it. Everybody that's on that list, that's listed on it. Whether you're also following them as a regular following option in Twitter or you only have them in a list, doesn't matter. They will come through as this separate stream when you're watching a stream of your individual list. You'll see each list individually streaming one at a time. So it's a secondary way to be able to follow people as well, that you want to keep them on a list. It really functions like a live interactive Rolodex. It's the place to put people for whatever reason you want to have them on your list, some of whom you're following all the time, some you're not, some you might dip in and out. I have many lists of journalists all over the world I don't necessarily need to be following all the time. They're on my list when a story breaks in a particular place, there's something going on that I know is that person's area of expertise, I'll go And I might click and follow them for a while. But I know, it makes it easy for me to find them. I know they're on my list. When, let's give an example, there's a hurricane. Well, I have a list for science, weather, and health. Now, I would have an individual list for each one of those things. But since Twitter only gives us 20 lists we can make, I had to combine those three into one. When there's a storm, I go to my list. And I see all of these wonderful people and organizations that I know are going to, pardon the pun, be tweeting up a storm because there's a hurricane someplace. And this is a way I don't have to reinvent the wheel. I don't have to figure out, oh, my gosh, who should I follow? Who should I go, take a look at their Twitter feed and see what kind of information? I got to start from scratch. Well, no, you don't have to do that. You've got all these people basically in this Rolodex type list. And so, there are lots of wonderful uses for these lists. And of course, you have to maintain them because people change jobs, various organizations come and go. Some of them still exist, but maybe they aren't tweeting much anymore. They've become inactive. So you want to do maintenance on your list to make sure you keep them current.
You've alluded a few times in this conversation, and we talked briefly about it before we started recording, that you've been a journalist for over 30 years, as have I. And we both, you know, emerged in a print journalism world, and it's not a print journalism world anymore. What are your thoughts, just initially? What's your first thought about the way this has changed?
Since I've been on the planet long enough to have seen a lot of changes, and to have also seen what people predicted would happen and didn't, my stand on print is informed a lot by the hysteria that went on around the time I was born. In 1956, television, you know, was beginning to become this powerhouse, and all of the so-called experts were claiming, oh, that's the death of movies. Nobody's ever going to go to the theater again. They can just stay home and watch TV. Well, it wasn't the death of movies. There was also the prediction. Everybody's always very quick to predict the death of things that most of the time don't happen. Things change. Certainly, a lot of the forms of media have morphed over the years, but they don't necessarily die. People have been predicting for years the death of radio, the death of film, the death of television, the death of this, the death of that. It's crap. It's not true. Every generation likes to predict these things, and if you look at the long arc of history, you find that none of it happened in that way. So now the latest thing is, they're predicting the death of print just because we have online. Well, print's not going to die. It's changing. It is compatible with online, just like television and film are compatible with each other. You don't have to kill one off in order to take the best advantage of the other. And so I think, print isn't going anywhere. I believe that it's growing into something that is going to be different, obviously, as just like radio changed. When television came in, they said it's the end of radio. Well, no, it changed. It offered different things and in a different way, but it was not the death of radio, just like it wasn't the death of film either. So I don't think print's going anywhere. I think that it's just changed.
Are you at all concerned then about the business model of the print journalism?
What I'm concerned about is the greed that is destroying print. Print isn't being harmed primarily by the internet. That's a myth. Print is being harmed by the greed of corporate owners who insist on having as much money in their own pockets as is humanly possible. And, if you sell a product and you say, well, my sales are down, but I insist on having the same amount of profit in my pocket that I had last year when sales were up. I'm not going to have my line my pocket with less than that. It's not going to be proportional to what my sales are. If my sales are down, I will not put up with having my pocket have less in it. I insist on having the same amount. Well, the only way to do that is to begin to gut the thing you own, to spend less, to lay people off, to bit by bit begin to essentially destroying your product. So they're essentially like vampires. They are taking as much money, the blood of these companies, and putting it into their pocket. It's got to come from someplace because, profits go up, profits go down. If they insist on having the same amount of money in their pocket, even when sales are down, well, the only way they're going to be able to do that is to stop spending money that should be spent on things that are important. And so that's what's been happening. And you have corporate owners who insist on having this large pocket of money, And the only way they can do that is to begin to cut insane corners on their product. And that is more of a harm to any product than the internet could ever be. If they weren't doing that, then this transition would not have been as painful for print. You know, there's a big movement in certain areas for journalism to become nonprofit, you know, in part take away this problem of, you know, the corporate raping, essentially, of these companies. I think having magazines and newspapers be nonprofit is in some ways a wonderful idea because it takes away the incentive to gut the thing. I don't know if this will ever come to be, but I do think that the greed of these corporations is the biggest problem, not the internet.
I would agree with you a lot on that. That you know, trying to maintain a margin that is, and at the same time, gutting your staff, basically destroying the quality of what, you know, what your product is. To the point where, you know, it's not even viable to mm-hmm. to exist as a media outlet anymore. I think we all have seen that. So, you know, the papers of the and magazines that have folded, maybe they died the happy death, or at least the death that was most merciful, rather than the ones that linger with smaller staffs.
Yeah.
And that sort of set. Well, what is your hope then for the future of journalism right now?
Well, you know, since I've always also written humor, I have these things kind of commingled in my mind to answer this question. It has become very difficult to write satire because reality has become so bizarre that you know, a popular thing to do on Twitter when you see a really bizarre story is to tweet a link to it with the comment, "This is not from The Onion," because the headline on this story or the description of it is so bizarre that it sounds like a parody. It sounds like satire. It sounds like something that could come from The Onion or from any other, you know, humor publication or program. But it's real, and so it makes we're living in such bizarre times that it has become so difficult to do satire because the things that you would have done as satire, these very things are actually happening.
Yeah, they're doing a good enough job on their own of making the ridiculous entertaining.
Exactly. And so for those of us who do satire and parody, boy, our job has gotten so difficult.
So it's triggering the death of satire is what this really the discussion is.
Reality has become a bigger satire than any insane thing you could think of as parody mm-hmm. or satire. And so when you look at the future of journalism, we're sort of looking at that happening within journalism, that things have gotten so nonsensical, so stupid, so ridiculous, that it almost looks like journalism has become a parody of itself. And these things are arising, I think, from these greedy choices that are being made, that are being the excuses that these companies are making. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's when you hear their explanations, you know, obviously they're grasping at something that they think might make sense, because the truth is not something they're ever going to tell you. They're not going to say we're greedy bastards and that's why we're doing it. Mm-hmm. So instead, they try to come up with some feel good reason that makes no sense. It sounds exactly like a parody. You know. You know, when they do something to screw over the consumer and say, "Oh, we're doing this to make our customers happy. We think this will give you a better user experience." Like, no, you're destroying our user experience. You're doing this to line your pocket, you know. So essentially, we see in journalism and in any other business, parody and satire, basically, is what this looks like, except that it's real. So, you know, I don't know what the future of journalism is going to be, but there are an awful lot of us making a lot of noise in the hope that it's not destroyed. Because no matter which way you look at it, essentially the common enemy is greed.
Well, I think that's a really good place to sort of wrap it up. Thank you very much, Nina, for giving me a few minutes of your time. And
my pleasure.
You have a good day and enjoy the ongoing parade of satire that's out there.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of the media. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about us at itsalljournalism.com. We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com. Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @AllJournalism.